You're streaming the Difference Makers podcast, presented by the Savannah Economic Development Authority. On today's episode, local attorney Brad Harmon, the managing partner at Hunter McLean, shares insights on the firm's 140 years of service to Savannah. Good day to you. I'm Adam Van Brummer, your host, and this is Difference Makers, where we interview Savannah area community leaders about what they do, how they do it, and why. Difference Makers hail from several sectors, including commerce, government, education, arts and culture, and philanthropy. You probably recognize the names or at least the organizations that these Difference Makers represent. This podcast is a chance to learn what makes them so successful. Our latest Difference Maker is Brad Harmon. He's currently the managing partner at Savannah's largest law firm, Hunter McLean. Joined today by Brad Harmon, who is the managing partner of Hunter McLean, the largest law firm in all of Savannah. He's our latest difference maker, and he's coming in. We kind of tied it a little bit to the fact that it's Hunter McLean's 140th anniversary, which in Savannah is pretty impressive. I know that maybe we here at the paper have a longer history, but we might be one of the few that really do. But first, Brad, thanks for coming in and spending some time with us this morning.
Adam, I really appreciate that. Happy to be here. Looking forward to chatting with you.
So we're going to start where we usually do, and I know that you said before we lit up the microphones that you don't necessarily like to talk about yourself, but we're going to force you to do it anyway.
All right.
One of these things about the biographies that we do is people, they probably recognize your name. They might see you on the street, recognize who you are, but they know what you do, but they don't necessarily know a whole lot about you. So I know you were born and raised in one of the prettiest places in America, right? Sevierville.
All right. Sevierville, Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg, Tennessee. That's right.
In the mountains.
That's right.
So were you playing around in the mountains, or were you more in the more cosmopolitan part of the?
No, it was a true hillbilly experience growing up. We were in the mountains. It was a great place to grow up. Beautiful place, as you've described. My parents still live there. I have a lot of family there in East Tennessee, in the mountains, and in North Carolina across the border. Mm-hmm. And went to school at University of Tennessee for college. My parents did everything they could to dissuade me from doing that because they thought I would go to this large party school and maybe flunk out. Luckily, that didn't happen. No, I did okay. And then went to Mercer University for law school, where I met my now wife, Heather, who's a lawyer here in town as well. So her parents lived in Hilton Head, and when we graduated from law school, we moved on down to Savannah in 2002, and we've been here ever since.
Where did your parents want you to go? East Tennessee State?
Anywhere but Tennessee.
They had that reputation, huh?
Right.
That's funny, because I went to school in Ohio. I went to Ohio University, which when my parents were kids was, for lack of a better term, it was in southeastern Ohio where they grew a lot of marijuana.
Yeah, and right.
Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton, and everybody was coming in and playing, and it was always on the Playboy list of top party schools. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I didn't partake in it,
right.
But it's kind of interesting the parents' vision of a mm-hmm. school and how it lasts over the years and transfers
right.
to their child, right?
Yeah, my experience is very similar to what you just described. That, I mean, I enjoyed my time there, but ultimately I got a degree, and that worked out well.
So growing up in the mountains, did you do a lot of hiking, or was it more basketball, baseball?
It was basketball and soccer, some swimming a little bit, but year round. I mean, that's what we did. But when I was a younger, being a hillbilly, we were required to climb trees. So as a younger child, my brother and I would spend most of our times outdoors, just playing around, you know, doing a little bit of climbing, doing some very limited amateur fishing and things of that mm-hmm. nature.
Older yeah. brother, younger brother?
Younger brother.
Younger
yeah.
brother.
Younger
so
brother.
You ruled the roost a little bit.
Well, I wish that would be the description. No. It was 2 years younger. So if I think your children are relatively close in age. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's lots of gnashing of teeth right. when you're that age. But he actually went on to become a lawyer in Nashville. So. Right. My family went from having no lawyers in it to having four pretty quickly when he and I both graduated from law school and both married lawyers. Yeah, that happens often, strangely.
Right. So you didn't come from your parents weren't lawyers? Were they
blue collar?
Were they professional?
My parents were educators. My dad was at one point was assistant superintendent of schools where I grew up. Was a principal. My mom was a teacher and principal, and my dad coached teams and things of that nature. And they both retired from. They were lifelong school teachers, mm-hmm. So they both retired from the education system up there. And so, you know, growing up, education was paramount. That was because of that sort of context in which we grew up.
Right. So that was probably the biggest influence was from your parents was education-wise.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and we had I was fortunate to have all four of my grandparents growing up, and they were just great people, and they were big influences as well on all of the grandchildren up there. So it was a great place to grow up. It really was. And it reminds me a lot in some ways of Savannah, was sort of the you have a tight-knit community and a beautiful place. And so, you know, it's nice to have grown up in a place and then to now be living somewhere similar.
Before we move on from there, I have to ask you about Smoky Mountain National Park and Dollywood.
Yes.
What being local, did you have as much fun with them as people that visited?
So I can remember when Dollywood was called Silver Dollar City, before it was rebranded with Dolly's name. We would go there periodically. So I went to Pigeon Forge Middle School, and Dollywood is in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And if they would have a new, each year, you know, they'd have some new roller coaster.
Sure.
And before they would open for the season, they would have the school kids come in and ride it. So test it out.
Very nice.
So that was fun. That part was fun. But during the season, so to speak, we would never, you know, we'd never go to Dollywood because that's, that would be like living in Orlando and trying to go to Disney World on July 4th.
Right.
You know, it was just, it was too packed. You know, but National Park is great. My family had a couple of hotels in Gatlinburg and actually would work the third shift when I got to be older. And by that, I mean like 18. Mm-hmm. And I'd spend a lot of time in the National Park. You could hike up beautiful places, you know, even just sort of right off the parkway, you could find waterfalls and great places. I mean, it's a beautiful place. It really is.
Yeah. So Dolly Parton, was she a bit of a mystical figure in town, or was she pretty
She lived mainly in Nashville, but she was always around. She would, you know, have a parade. She had this, she was very good to the people of that community. She started a program, which now has gone worldwide, about giving books to young children to start them reading early. When I was in high school, she had a system. It was something like Dolly's Buddies. I'm not sure exactly what the term was, where you and a friend had to pair up as freshmen in high school, and if you both graduated, then you got $500 apiece from Dolly, and you'd go get a picture with her and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, very nice.
They did away with that the year that I started high school, but be it as it may, it always stuck with me that, you know, she didn't have to do those things, but she wanted to incentivize people to finish their education. I joke when I meet people and they never heard of Pigeon Forge or Gatlinburg. I say, well, I'm from Dollywood.
Right.
Basically, they get
it.
Know that. I went to high school on Dolly Parton Parkway.
There you go.
So, yeah, she's a big influence there locally. You know, she gives back quite a bit.
And the other part of that is country music. Is everybody country music fans there? Are you a country music fan?
Not particularly. I mean, I know a lot of the older country music because growing up, that was what that was what was always being played. But we would also spend some time in Nashville, which is about three and a half hours away, and that's obviously the cradle of country music. So, yeah, it's big pretty much all over the state. It didn't really take as much with me, but that happens, I suppose.
Let's go down to Knoxville. Did you know when you went to UT that law was where you wanted to end up?
No, I went and had a couple of. I was an architecture major when I started, which is again still profession, but pretty far away from the law. I had a couple of classes and decided I was going to do something different, and so went into the political science major. And ultimately, I decided that probably made sense to try to go to law school.
Right.
I didn't want to be a lawyer. I mean, was going to law school and did not want to be a lawyer, which is completely counterintuitive.
What was the plan then?
The plan was that I knew that I was probably not ready to get out and get into the workforce, and I've always wanted to get a professional degree. So once I got to law school, I realized I'd made the right choice, that it was the right thing for me to do.
In law school, you can go work in law enforcement. You can go work in political and politics.
That's right. Having a law degree gives you a lot of flexibility. You know, you don't have to be a lawyer, but ultimately that's what I chose to do, and it's worked out, I think, pretty well. I went down to Macon, law school in Macon.
Connection there? Why not stay in Tennessee? Because does Tennessee have a law?
It does. Tennessee has a law school. But I kind of knew there's the super senior concept. Have you heard that?
Okay.
Well, so I was not a super senior. I graduated in 4 years, and all of my friends were taking another football season, basically.
You needed to get out.
And I knew that I needed to get out of there. Ultimately, it helped because I either was waitlisted or didn't get into Tennessee Law School, whatever it was. So that made the decision for me. But I knew that I wanted to do something else. I don't want to say see the world because I wanted to stay in the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
Looked at a few schools, Wake Forest, Memphis, and Mercer, and applied, you know, to Vanderbilt and all these other places. When I came down to visit Mercer, it was in March, so it was 72 degrees. The cherry blossoms were blooming. They had all these festivals downtown. I thought, wow, this is a really great place. Met a guy there that I lived with my first couple of years. So I made a decision to go to Mercer, which, again, it was a great decision,
it's
great school.
Flat, though.
It is very flat, town. Very different. But when I first got there for orientation, it was 158 degrees. Oh, yeah. And I thought, wow, this is, I don't know what happened. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that's an impetuousness of youth, I guess. Anyway, it worked out great. I met my wife there, got a great education.
That was my next question, right. That's where you met.
That's right. That's Heather. Heather, that's right.
When you get out of Mercer, or you're getting ready to get out of Mercer, what leads you to this end of I-16?
So my in-laws, soon-to-be in-laws at that point in time, had retired from Pittsburgh to Hilton Head. Right. So my girlfriend / fiance really wanted to get close to them. And so we made a deal that I would look for jobs in Tennessee and Atlanta and maybe Charlotte, and she would look in this area. Mm-hmm. And whoever got the job first, that's where we would go. So she got the job first, and we headed down here, which has been, you know, we had been to Savannah a bunch beforehand, so I knew it was a great place to live. We headed here in 2002. I worked for a sole practitioner when I first got here, and then worked for a smaller firm for a couple of years, and had been at Hunter McLean since end of 2005 or beginning 2006. So
by the time you were done with law school, you knew you wanted to actually practice, and you were going to go ahead and chase the bar.
Right. That's right. We could take the bar exam because getting ready to get married, I had to have some income. Mm-hmm. And you may recall in 2001, 2002, we were still in the depths of a recession. So the majority of legal jobs that were available was litigation, which I didn't really have an interest in doing, but now I've been doing it for 17 years. Mm-hmm. So it's funny how things work out. So most of the firms that we're hiring were litigation-based firms, and so that set my path, my course for the next 15, 17 years.
I was going to say, at that point, you're probably looking at either litigation or estate type
stuff. That's right. Yeah, a lot of the corporate transaction stuff there wasn't a lot going on at that point in time.
Yeah. So you move into town, you start working in the business.
Right.
What part of town are you living in? What are your impressions of Savannah?
So we moved into a bungalow in Ardsley, which is great. It was a great place, and we loved living there. And we both worked downtown, and it was being young, a young professional with no children. It was a fun place to be. Lots to do, lots going on weekends. You know, there's always people. It was a vibrant city. You know, people are walking around on Saturday and Sundays. There's always a festival going on, and so we were, you know, that's what we did. We just, I didn't say took everything in that Savannah had to offer, but I'll put it this way. I'm too old now to be doing that all the time on weekends. Oh, I would be worn out, for example.
I think we all are.
Yeah.
And then, of course, after that, you go ahead and start a family. And
that's right.
That brings you to where we are today. Difference Makers Podcast is a great way to learn about Savannah and those who make the city tick. But there's a catch, of course, the 2-week wait between episodes. Keep up with all that's going on in our town on a more regular basis by signing up for our free newsletters. We deliver an opinion page newsletter daily, and our news team does likewise. And for the foodies and Georgia Southern fans among the audience, weekly newsletters on those topics are available as well. Visit savannahnow.com/newsletters now to get those newsletters delivered straight to your email inbox. Again, that's savannahnow.com/newsletters. You end up at Hunter McLean.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And are you just kind of toiling in the ranks for a while, or what's the climb or the path?
Yeah, so I was hired to work for two lawyers named Chris Phillips, Kirby Mason. I've been indebted to them forever because they took a chance on me. But they did medical malpractice defense and construction work, and Kirby also would do some employment work. So I was their associate. I worked a lot of hours, and we had a lot of the sort of younger associates working a lot of hours at the time. But I'd suggest that I was putting in as much or more. So be that as it may, sort of broadened my practice to really focus on certain types of business litigation. But yeah, to answer your question, at that point in time, it was a little bit of toiling in the ranks.
Right.
And then throughout the way the firm structured is, after a certain number of years, you're eligible to be considered for partnership. And I was ultimately elected partner, and that was in 2010. So it really wasn't that long ago, although now I'm saying it, it seems like about a decade. Yeah.
So then you get to the point where you're main managing partner. So I'm kind of envisioning this as your name's Harmon, so you're not a hunter, you're
right.
McLean.
Right.
Did they line all the partners up and say, okay, who wants to be managing partner, step forward, and you were the only one that didn't step backward?
How did that come about? You know, that's how some of my partners would describe the process, but it's more involved than that. So our firm is structured where we have three management committee members, one of whom has to be the managing partner, and those are voted on by the partnership at large. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like the Senate. There's an election each year, it's a staggered terms, I guess I should say. So I had held a number of administrative roles in the firm since becoming a partner in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then Frank McGill, my immediate predecessor as managing partner, put me in a rotating position on the management committee where it's just a training ground. Mm-hmm. And the discussion at that point was, you know, he was relatively young as managing partner because he may either not even be 50 years old at this point, and this would have been 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it became clear to me that he, without him having to tell me, that he had identified me as his possible, maybe not likely, but possible successor. Mm-hmm. And then what you do, the concept, or at least in the DNA law firm, is put people in these administrative roles to see what, to test their mettle, give them some experience, and then you have built a bench depth from which you can choose your firm leadership. Right. And that's what we do. And so, there's a concept a lot of times that the law firms are old, stodgy, and you got a bunch of old white guys that are the leadership. And right now, we've got some relatively young people in our firm leadership. And that's what's been one thing great about the firm is it's been willing to, I don't say take risks, but go outside of a hard cast model.
Unorthodox.
Yeah. We do what is in the best long-term interest of the firm. Mm-hmm. Don't do something just because that's what's always been done. Mm-hmm. So, they made Frank McGill the managing partner, I think, when he was 40. Mm-hmm. Made me the managing partner when I was 38. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sure some of our partners had some concern about having such youth, right. But it's worked. I mean, the firm's doing well, so we've had consistency of leadership. I'm not necessarily patting myself on the back. It's our whole team.
Right.
That's what's one of the good things about the firm.
Yeah. When you say managing partner, you talk about administrative roles. What exactly is the difference between the managing partner and the other partners? What extra duties do you have?
I can talk about how that works in our firm. All firms are different
right.
when it comes to that role.
Right.
Some have sort of a CEO based model, but ours, for what our managing partner does, is set the most paramount job is to set the long term strategic direction of the firm.
Okay.
Now you solicit input from all your partners
sure.
regularly,
yep.
and we got a process for our processes for that. So you set whether you can describe it in vague terms or very definitive descriptions. Where you want to be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, because one of my roles as managing partner, again, is to be a steward of the law firm where we prosper not just now, but we're prospering 20 years from now and 30 years from now when I'm gone to help the people that you want to recruit and retain quality, good lawyers that fit our culture. Mm-hmm. And so we're thinking about people that aren't here yet.
Right.
I mean, we're thinking 7, 10, 20 years down the road about what do we do now to make us stronger there?
Right.
Now, it's a little bit of a catch-22 because the current partners appropriately say we want to, this is a job. We want to have good income and we want to represent sophisticated clients. We want to do work we like. So those two, the here and now versus the long-term strategic direction, those that sometimes appear to be at odds. So that's a little bit
sure.
of a balancing act. So that's the paramount thing of the managing partner does. And then the next on the list of the pecking order would be, manage the day-to-day operations of the firm. But we have a significant amount of administrative staff, professional staff to help us do that.
Yeah, because you're not billing hours a lot of times when you're...
Well, lately I have been, but yes, you're right. I mean, so we're not large enough to where you can have the management committee no longer practice law. I mean, we have to have some sort of practice. And being 42, I want to have a practice for the next few years. I mean, whenever I stop doing this, I want to be able to contribute to the firm meaningfully
sure.
in other ways. So it's a little bit of a tough balance at times. Larger firms, many of the large, great firms in Atlanta, someone goes to be the managing partner and they won't practice law again.
Sure.
That's what they will do for the rest of their career, whether it's 5 years, whether it's 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite at that level yet because, but who knows, maybe we'll do something like that in the next few years. So yeah, it's interesting because right now through our management committee consists of myself, Sean Catchmar, who's a school board member, I believe you know, and Tom Cullen, who's our he's our real estate practice group leader, even though he does corporate work. Mm-hmm. And we are three of the highest billers this year, which is an aberration, but that happens. And what you typically want, the people that the firm has chosen as the firm leaders usually are quality lawyers. Again, I'm setting myself outside of this. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to, I told you I didn't like talking about myself. But historically, they're quality lawyers. And so people tend, they have qualities that, good leadership qualities as well. So the people on our management committee ultimately typically have a busy practice.
Sure.
Which complicates things because then you've got to run the firm at the same time. Right. But we've found a happy medium, at least over the past few years, and things have been doing pretty well.
Good.
Yeah.
Mentioned the last few years, as I mentioned at the top, 140th anniversary this year.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk me through kind of the history of the firm. I know some of the names involved were pretty major names, not only in town, but statewide.
Yeah, yeah. So law firms historically would change their name when you would add a partner or drop a partner. And so back in 1879, and again, let me just set the, if I can have a brief aside, let me just sure. set the scene for 1879. So how long ago that was, you had President Rutherford B. Hayes signed into law an act that permitted women to practice in front of the United States Supreme Court, which is interesting that was ever an issue. And so additionally, you had that, I think that was the year that Georgia's own Doc Holliday killed his first man in somewhere in Arizona.
Wild West.
Yeah. And then Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. So, I mean, that's how long ago that was. You know, we didn't even have
contact.
Yeah. So there's that. So two men named N.C. Collier and Walter Charlton formed a firm called Collier and Charlton. I'll spare you the rest of the 85 iterations. People joined that firm, left that firm. There were firm mergers. Ultimately, that firm became known in 1980 as Hunter McLean, Exley & Dunn, P.C., and the name has never changed since. Mm-hmm. And to your point, Adam, we have had a number of, through that 140 years history, we've had a number of partners that have been influential both in locally and the public sector as well as in statewide. Obviously, Malcolm McLean, that's the McLean. He was a mayor of Savannah from 60 to 66, who helped along with W.W. Law and other esteemed.
That's right.
He helped peacefully integrate the city with the help of all those esteemed civil rights leaders. And I didn't know Malcolm. He passed away right before I got to town, but many of our partners worked with him, and his fingerprints are still on the law firm. He is a guiding hand for the law firm, sort of just the way that he operated and the things that he believed. And, you know, a day doesn't go by that I don't hear one of our older partners, and sometimes not even that older, mention something about Malcolm or give a quote. And with regard to the civil rights era, the statement was from him, as I understand it, was we're going to integrate because that's the law, mm-hmm. and it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you know, they were on the right side of history and did that, but that got him. He didn't get reelected,
right?
But you know, but that's fine. That we're proud of that. You know, I mean, that's a big part of our history. The Hunter in Hunter McLean was Colonel Ormond Hunter, whose brother has Hunter Army Airfield named after him.
Okay.
So there's a connection there. I mean, prior to that, as you and I just mentioned this to you a little bit earlier, I just sort of found this out recently, but one of our partners many years ago at the turn of the century, around the 1900s, was named Anderson Randolph, and he was effectively, as you and I discussed, was a lieutenant governor. I guess the actual title is ex officio successor to the governor for a while, and he was a state senator as well in that time, and he helped, as I understand it, found an agricultural school in Statesboro, which ultimately became Georgia Southern. So that's a pretty neat tie.
CSX, he was big with
that's
CSX.
That's right, big with CSX, its predecessor. That's right. Yeah, so we could sit here and go through tons of different individuals that the firm has had. And we've been fortunate to have quality people like that throughout our history. We have quality people like that now, and we have quality people that come and go elsewhere, and we're proud of those people too. We've had, Brooke Stillwell, who you may know, the most recent city attorney, he was an alumni of Hunter McLean. Bates Lovett, a good friend of mine, he's the current interim city attorney. So we have a lot of people that leave and do great things. We, like as I shared with you, we want to support our people. to where they can succeed, whether that's with us or somewhere else. We prefer it not to be at a competitor, but if you want to go do something else, we support that, and we're happy. And we have people that leave and come back often. I mean, that happens regularly. So,
we are speaking with Savannah attorney Brad Harmon of Hunter McLean on this episode of the Difference Makers podcast. Before we continue our discussion, let's pause and recognize the Difference Makers presenting sponsor and a real difference maker in our community, the Savannah Economic Development Authority. The team at CEDA is pushing to make Savannah a great place to work and live. CEDA is committed to creating, growing, and attracting jobs and investment in the Savannah region. Whether a business looking to relocate to the Savannah region or an existing business ready to grow and expand, CEDA is the centrifuge of a propeller, making the connections, helping propel the business to success. Learn more about the Savannah Economic Development Authority and what they do in the Savannah community by visiting CEDA.org. Now back to Brad Harmon.
That's 140 years.
Yep.
Where are you now? And more importantly, where are you going? What's the next, maybe not 140 years?
Right. Right.
10, 20.
Well, yeah, I can probably speak to the next 10 to 20. So we're a business firm. I mean, we don't do criminal work. We don't do domestic work. We help businesses and individuals solve problems. That's what we do. That's what the firm really has always done. So we've got, you know, large corporate clients. We've got small clients. And so we have, as you and I briefly discussed before we got on the podcast, about 25-ish years ago, the firm made a decision to specialize. John Houston was the managing partner at that time, and he said, listen, we need to try to get away from being business generalists. Let's try to create niches for ourselves. So there was an intentional attempt and successful attempt to try to have specialized practices that we believed the future clients would need. So they tried to serve the current need, but then you got to look out, you know, the next 5-10 years to try to find out what is on the horizon and build that. You know, it's not instantaneous profit. I mean, you have to sink costs into building sort of the experience, and we still do that. So we do that regularly. We try to look out about what is on the horizon or where there might be work that needs to get done, what types of clients there will be. And I'll give you a good example, relatively recent example. We started a few years ago a logistics practice group because the port was already large here, but in Georgia in particular, I mean, that is a, you know, logistics and transportation is a huge arena. So we've got a number of really specialized logistics lawyers like Chris Smith, Colin McRae, David Sippel, myself to some degree. Randy Jordan and Chris Jordan are railroad lawyers. They're down in our St. Simon's office. So we've got a really big bench depth of these experts in that arena. And at the outset, we didn't have a lot of work in that arena, but now those folks are pretty much full up with lots to do. So that's an example of what I'm describing. We've gotten some lawyers that we've brought from New York and Chicago and Atlanta that could be anywhere. And they have clients that are located in, you know, Lisbon or Dusseldorf or wherever it may be, or San Marino Valley, and it doesn't matter where they are. And so they say they want to come to a nice place to live, and they either want to come to the beach or, you know, Hilton Head or Tybee or St. Simon. So we've been able to recruit lately, and we're still focused on that, people with those specialized skills. And it's changed things a little bit for the law firm. So about 40% of our clientele is based here. And by here, I don't mean Savannah. I mean the Georgia coast-ish area, including, you know, down in our St. Simon's office area. Running, you know, into Florida, a little bit into South Carolina, and then the rest of 60% is just elsewhere. And by that, I mean, you know, Seattle, they're based wherever. They just either have a need here locally, or we have a lawyer that is specialized and does their work nationwide or in some limited cases globally. So that's the firm. That's been a change over the past 25 years, you know, and that's I think it's probably going to continue to change.
Expertise and reputation are a big deal.
That's right.
Well, a lot of people, when they think of planning and zoning in this town, they think of Harold Yellen.
Right, exactly. My partner, Harold Yellen. Right.
They think of employment law. They think of Sean. We mentioned Sean Cashmore earlier. What does it take to kind of build that reputation? At what point does the firm get a reputation where somebody says, well, I've got an issue in this area? Hunter McLean does. I don't know if they have the person I'm looking for, but because of who they are, they're calling you guys. How much of that?
That's a really good question. That's a great question. I'll use Harold as the test case. So Harold, when he joined the firm years ago, he joined and he did admiralty work. Some of the individuals I just mentioned a little bit ago do admiralty work, which I jokingly refer to as pirate law, but it's very specialized. So Harold did that a little bit, and then there were a couple of zoning matters that came in from a client, and we didn't have the expertise at that point, as I understand it. So Harold was told by, I believe, Malcolm McLean, said, you have to learn this because we believe this is going to be a niche practice. And he did it, and Harold is one of the best in the state when it comes to the zoning stuff, planning and zoning. So many years ago, he had one opportunity, and the firm said, we'll support you in this. You know, we'll send you to seminars. We'll, you know, buy whatever materials you need to learn it. But the best way to learn it is to try it. He's been very successful in that regard. So that's how we sort of start having that sort of expertise. I'll also use Sean Catchmar as an example because you mentioned him. Sean had worked in employment. So he had a background as an employment lawyer for a firm in Atlanta, and then I believe he went to Charleston. So he joined us, and we already had Wade Herring, our senior partner in that employment arena, and Sarah Lamar. And so Sean joined them as an associate, and when Sarah and Wade were already the go-to people, for lack of a better term, and so Sean became known in the employment arena because of his connection to them, and then he has built his own reputation through very quality work. And so now we have two or three younger associates there that hopefully one day the same thing will happen to them. So those are two different types of contexts, one where we didn't have the practice area with Harold and it just happened upon it, and then he built it into something that's important to the firm. Another one, the employment practice, which I think Wade primarily built years ago, was there when Sean joined, but he's now gotten the reputation because he had the ability to work on interesting cases for quality clients. And so we have that, luckily, I mean, we're fortunate. We've been fortunate over 140 years to be able to have really quality engagements with quality clients. I mean, that's been, and what's the old adage, I'd rather be lucky than good?
Yeah.
I mean, we've been fortunate to have clients that we can do that type of work for.
Another part of building a reputation is being known in the community. And I know
that's right.
Hunter McLean, when you look at boards of nonprofits around the area and even government boards, you see your folks on there. What is the whole approach in terms of that kind of service?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Adam. So the firm's DNA includes commitment to the community. When we recruit people, either a lateral partner or someone out of law school, we from elsewhere, or if it's someone we recruit here locally, we make sure they understand how important it is to be involved in the community, one way or the other. We're not saying you're required to be on a nonprofit board, although candidly, that's what ends up happening. So what we say is, look, whatever you're passionate about, find out what you're passionate about, and I bet there's a way we can get you involved in the community. Most of the time, that's on a nonprofit board, or it's on a elected governmental board, for example, with Sean Catchmar. We want our people involved in the community because we want to make Savannah, we want to make the future of Savannah bright for our children. We want to make the current Savannah stronger. I know that that's a vague term. The way to do that is to be involved. Give your time, and don't just be on a board. Participate.
You're talking arts and culture boards. You're talking United Way. You're talking Union Mission.
Union Mission. That's right. I'm on the Union Mission board. I'm passionate about that. And again, as I've briefly discussed, it's not entirely altruistic. It helps to make connections, sort of in any business, and that helps as well. But then you also get to know people on those boards in a different sort of context than just having a business transaction with them, and you get to know them more personally, and that creates more of a sense of a tighter community. Right. So, we always support our people. We support those causes, those boards. I mean, not just with our time, but with our money as well. I mean, it's very important to the firm. It's always been that way, as far as I understand. And it sort of goes back. We always talk about Malcolm McLean, but I mean, his big deal was you need to be involved in this community because if you want to improve the community, then you have to put your both money and time where your mouth is.
Yeah. When you're talking about a guy who served as mayor,
that's right.
That's a pretty high standard.
Yeah, that's true.
So before we move off of the firm and into some more legal topics, I want to hit on the context of Hunter McLean. As we said at the opening, Hunter McLean's the biggest law firm in town. You're talking about 60 lawyers, where when you go to Atlanta, that's a small or
it's a media. That would be a mid-sized firm anywhere. I mean, you know, although I went to a conference recently where they described mid-sized firms as being between 400 and 700 lawyers. Wow. I disagreed with that part. No, it'd be, you know, if you're in a large metropolitan area, it's a smaller firm or mid-sized firm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's firms in Atlanta that are global, and their Atlanta offices alone have 400 to 600, 700
Denton's
lawyers.
Denton's is one of the...
Well, Denton's is the largest firm in the world. They have, as I understand it, over 10,000 lawyers now globally, which I can't even imagine what that...
Managing partner.
Yeah. Well, so their managing partner, the chairman, as they call him, I've heard him... I've met him a couple times at some conferences and heard him speak at these places. And it's interesting. I mean, he gets peppered with questions all the time about how are you able to keep that from just spinning out of control. Yeah. So, yeah, but King & Spalding is a very large global firm. You know, the great reputation here based in Atlanta. Alston & Byrd, same thing. And then there's, you know, there's great firms everywhere. Arnell, Golden & Gregory, who we work with on a couple of engagements, they're great lawyers. They probably get about 100 lawyers. So, you know, from Atlanta, that's probably considered mid-size, but again, they got really quality lawyers at all those places, though. Right. So, yeah, in our context, being 60 lawyers, while it may seem that we're large here locally, it's with the counsel that we typically compete for engagements with elsewhere, and those that are our co-counsel elsewhere, we are much smaller.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting spot to be in.
Yeah, and that's even though you guys have a broad focus. You are still focused. You're not getting into lobbying, per se.
No, that's right.
You're not leading, you mentioned earlier, not into criminal law.
Right.
You're not necessarily into personal injury law.
Right.
We do some
personal injury defense, limited personal injury defense. I mean, we've got some really good medical malpractice lawyers who do, you know, the defense work. We've got, as part of our logistics group, we do represent trucking and transportation companies, and they, you know, they'll be involved in accidents, so we'll do the defense work of that, but yeah, not sort of the insurance defense type thing. We don't do a lot of that, although the primarily the admiralty work is through what's not called insurance companies, but P&I clubs, you know, who are located in Japan and England and Finland and, you know, all these other places. So it's a very fancy way of saying Admiralty Insurance. P&I clubs.
Maritime.
Yeah, right. Maritime. We there are firms that have lobbying arms. We've made the conscious decision not to get into that arena. We want to sort of focus on our core competencies, but you never know what the future holds on that regard.
Yeah. We interrupt the Difference Makers podcast to remind you about our other regular podcasts, such as the At Savannah Opinion Commute, hosted by yours truly, with a new episode that posts every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. The Commute is the easiest way to keep up with the latest news and happenings that Savannians are talking about. Search for The Commute with At Savannah Opinion on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. Episodes are also available through the SavannahNow.com website at SavannahNow.com/podcast. You can also check out our other podcasts, such as Georgia Southern Extra, with its focus on Georgia Southern football, the Do Savannah podcast, with its emphasis on local arts and entertainment, and the daily See You in the Morning podcast that offers a roundup of the day's headlines. And since we talk lobbying, let's talk a little bit about government. We're sitting here the morning after, on November the 6th, the morning after the election. And obviously we're looking at big changes come January here in town. And from as a business law firm who does a lot of government work, a lot of zoning work, what does, and I'm not asking you to get into specifics in terms of one way or the other, but what is the impact of government changes or government on a firm such as yours?
Well, this one will, you know, there were, it's going to be a completely different council, city council, and our lawyers periodically and sometimes regularly appear in front of council for a number of matters. So you're going to have uncertainty initially, but that's with any, you know, if this were city council in Des Moines, Iowa, it'd be the same thing if you had that many changes. Mm-hmm. So it'll be both the council getting to know the people that are in front of them, regularly asking for things on behalf of clients, such as our firm and other firms, and then vice versa. So a lot of there'll probably be a lot of education going both ways from the new council, new aldermen, and also from lawyers, for example. And that's what I'll speak to is the lawyers. I know right. you have other people that go in front and make requests. But so, you know, after a period, this isn't the first time this has happened, right? I mean, we had some fairly significant turnover back in 2015.
Yes.
It's the same thing. But just humans don't like change generally, and lawyers like change even less.
Right.
So it's just going to be some uncertainty for a while. And then I think once everyone gets to know each other a little bit better, I think that the process will be effective and efficient, and you know everyone's working toward the same goal, which is we want to improve the quality of life for Savannians, right? I mean that's what the new council wants, that's what we on behalf of our clients want to do. So it's interesting though. I mean you know you have this, and in our current political climate, both you know really nationally. That's what there is uncertainty. You know, everyone's sort of hyper focused on you know national politics, local as well here for us. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, there are 9 seats, I think. 6, and as many as 8 could ultimately, because we're going to have a runoff for 2 races, could be filled by people that don't have experience in government.
Mm-hmm.
For lawyers that have to go in front of council, for lawyers that end up working in some way, shape, or form with the city on some issues. How much does that going to require you guys to really drill down deeply in terms of educating them about policy, the law, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, you know, I don't do that work. I'm not trying to punt on the right. question. I don't do that work, so I can't really speak to what would happen in a typical situation like that. Mm-hmm. But it appears that all the individuals that were elected are smart folks that are going to be able to get this stuff. So, you know, whatever the issue may be. So there's going to be some time. I mean, there's going to be some for like a learning phase.
A
it's
learning
just like
curve.
Right, a learning curve. Right? I mean, in any job, you know, when you started, you know, there was a learning curve for you. When I became our managing partner, there was a learning curve. You know, most, you know, it's going, what's the old adage again? It's you're either going to sink or swim, you're probably going to swim.
Right.
So, again, I don't.
Elected
I can't
official you better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Elected official you better. Yeah, that's right.
Before we wrap up, one thing you brought up to me earlier was the impact on the legal profession of artificial intelligence.
And yeah, it's not something that you would typically think of. So when go to these law firm leadership conferences, a lot of the questions, or at least speakers, deal with, you know, what's coming around the corner and what's the biggest threat, for lack of a better term, and one of those is alternative legal providers, which are, you know, you've seen the, you know, not Rocket Mortgage, but those like Rocket Lawyers, something right. similar, right. you know, where it's, you know, the Robert Shapiro created a company, yeah, which his
legal,
name is LegalZoom. Yeah,
legal
yeah.
Zoom,
so that,
you
so you know, there's all of those sort of competition for traditional lawyers. But one of the things that is most concerning, at least at these conferences, is artificial intelligence. Because I'll use IBM Watson as the example, because that's the one that's ubiquitous for AI, and it's not even as advanced as the AI that we're talking about here. But Watson can review and process 10,000 pages of documents in a matter of seconds or maybe minutes, and then spit out a brief analysis of it. Right, so that's in part what some lawyers do. So that's concerning, because you're having computers effectively, or technology, take the place of a component of what we do. But the one thing that artificial intelligence has yet to be able to replicate is judgment, mm-hmm. is sort of human judgment.
Nuances.
And that's right, the yeah. nuances and discretion. So as long as we don't have a fully active artificial intelligence, lawyers should still have jobs. But it's interesting, and that's changed technology has changed practice. At least I've seen it in the 17 years I've been practicing. You know, we started, I don't say in the early days of the internet, but internet was utilized in different ways back in 2000, 2002. Email was around, but it was not the exclusive form of communication, which basically it is now at this juncture. So that those had all changed some things, and now we have software that are practice specific for our people that we invest in, because it's an efficiency tool. It makes them be able to get the work done, the competent work done, most efficiently, and our clients appreciate that. So technology, we try to take advantage of technology. We don't want to be on the bleeding edge, but we want to be at least ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
But some of that AI stuff is, it will, from everything we've seen, it's probably going to come into play more and more in the legal arena. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Very interesting, because that's one thing that always makes me chuckle about the law, is the law a lot of times is black and white, but lawyers can interpret things completely differently based on just looking at it, which I think
that's right.
Kind of one of the skills of attorneys. But it'll be interesting to see if they can get AI to figure out how to argue both sides
of
the same.
Well, see, that's why I think, at least for the I'll knock on wood here, that's why I think, at least for the foreseeable future, I'll still have a job. Because they haven't been able to replicate that judgment, the nuance, to be able to understand the sort of how to make those arguments.
That's what I tell people. I said, I only got 15 more years. I think that journalism is probably going to keep kicking for 15 more years. And
so you're good,
beyond
right?
that, so it's probably the same with AI and the law. But Brad, very interesting discussion. Thank you for coming in and sharing. And we wish you well over at Hunter McLean.
All right. Well, Adam, I really appreciate it. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks to Brad Harmon for sharing his story on Difference Makers. Thank you also to our presenting sponsor, the Savannah Economic Development Authority. Tap into the Difference Makers archives anytime on your favorite podcast app to hear interviews with more of Savannah's community leaders, such as Toys for Tots coordinator Sergeant Anthony Kingdom. Remember to buy some extra toys and drop them in the collection boxes between now and Christmas, by the way. You can also hear an interview with local high school basketball coach Tim Jordan and the Georgia Ports Authority's Griff Lynch. Difference Makers is a production of the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. Our next episode will post December the 27th and features Savannah's mayor-elect, Van Johnson. Thank you for listening.